You and I'll now turn it over to Guy.
Okay. Scott Brandenburg, I'm the current president of the National Council of Astronomers. And
But you
what
need
well
to speak up so that
okay.
people online can hear you as well, and people in the back can hear you.
Okay, should I come over there perhaps?
Yeah, you can kind of sit right here or.
All right, so we'll have past observing reports, we'll have upcoming events, announcements, and we'll have a talk by our own Vice President, Brian Vandervec. Thank you so much for doing this. And maybe observing tonight,
We'll
afterwards,
see.
we'll see. Okay, next. Is it working? All right. So, exploring the sky. Don't go away.
Okay.
Yeah. Month. Okay.
Last month, yes, we did have Exploring the Sky, and then we actually had two, I and one other person was there. Somebody else showed up. Oh, yes, showed up late. But yes, there was, so we had three people there. So we did have observing there because of government problems. We did not have any planetarium show. And the next Exploring the Sky is this coming Saturday, which will be held if the sky lets us. There again, whether or not we have a planetarium show depends on whether or not the government decides to get its act together. Also, as far as next year goes, I looked at a 2026 calendar and came to the conclusion that the third Saturday of the month is probably the best observing day for exploring the sky, April through November. So you can plan on that. I don't know what planets. I'll have to see what planets are up so I can fill out the rest of the schedule, and then we can publish it. I
Thank you.
figure on the third Saturday of the month.
Thank you. Chong, are you here?
Who?
Chong Wong, guess not.
John, are you online?
Chong.
Chong.
Okay. Well, I'll give the report on that. We had to cancel that because of the government shutdown. That's
Okay.
in the national park. And I was hoping we could just go ahead and do it anyway, but apparently no. And number three, the Mount Pleasant Sidewalk Astronomers. We had a blast on Halloween. That was a lot of fun. There were a lot of people, a lot of them in costumes coming out till well after midnight. It was a blast. Okay, telescope lending program. We still need volunteers for custodians, and we have lost our assistant secretary treasurer, who wouldn't have a whole lot to do because our current secretary treasurer does such a great job. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
But it would be nice to have a backup.
We're down to 38 people, I think, who have not renewed for this year. So I take money.
Okay. All right. And okay, so if you want to join our listserv, that's the place to do it. Capital Astronomers plus to subscribe at groups.io. Next. And this is the telescopes that we have on hand. These are all manual, and if you would like to be the custodian of one of them, let me know. Next slide. And let's see. Okay, so tomorrow, if you want to get some used astro equipment and you have some money, or if you have some equipment that you want to get rid of in exchange for money, you could go to the George Mason University. This is a NOVAC event, Northern Virginia Astronomy Club. As you probably know, there's a bunch of astronomy clubs not just in DC, but all over the place. And you don't have to be a member to go. That's the room, Exploratory Hall, room 3301. So this Tuesday, we normally have telescope making workshop at the Chevy Chase Community Center. Tuesday happens to be November 11th, and that's Armistice Day or Veterans Day, and that's not going to happen because everything's going to be closed. Also, the day after Thanksgiving, they always close the center. And Exploring the Sky is, as you said, a week from today. And our next meeting is on December 13th. And knocking on particle board, the government shutdown will be over. And
let's take bets.
What?
We should have a pool.
That's a bad idea. So hopefully that will be our discussion next month. Okay, next slide. And I read some emails from our the guy who was supposed to speak to us, and he was basically told no, he can't. Even though he's, you know, yes, he's furloughed, but since it's NASA stuff, he doesn't have permission to share that with us. And if you're wondering about Gail Gomez, our most enthusiastic sidewalk astronomer, the temporary protected status for Venezuelans and Haitians and Afghans ended yesterday, my understanding, and he and his family are in negotiations with lawyers, immigration lawyers, to try a different way to stay here. But you know, who knows what's going to happen? I don't. Okay. And this is our speaker. And by the way, any other announcements? Anybody have any announcements that want to make? Okay, so I looked on LinkedIn and looked at the patents, and yeah, BS from Cornell and MS from Johns Hopkins, and has done a whole bunch of stuff. And you can read about that in Stardust, and I'm not going to read all that. But chief technologist for artificial intelligence and autonomous systems at Booz Allen, which is, you'll have to explain a little bit about what that
sure.
is.
Sure.
And he's also an excellent amateur astronomer and astrophotographer, and has helped with a number of sidewalk astronomy events. And thank you very, very much.
Absolutely.
For doing this for us.
Sure.
Right, just give us a moment while we switch cables to.
Oh, it's the. Yeah. Hopefully this will work.
I should point out, as far as Exploring the Sky goes, last month we did not have any park police come by. I was afraid of that, but nobody came by, so we didn't have any problems. But I don't have the permit, because the permit is in the Nature Center. And the Nature Center is closed.
Oh man, that's rough. So start sharing.
So you're gonna need anybody to bail you out next month?
Yeah.
Get out of jail?
Well, you're the treasurer, maybe even.
Let me know.
Yeah, all right.
It just works.
That's not necessary.
There's something with me. Right, that's clean looking.
Fantastic. All right.
Yeah,
ready to go?
Good. Yeah.
But thank you so much, Guy. I appreciate the intro. Pleasure to be here with you all tonight. I'm Brian Vanderbeck. And as Guy had mentioned, because the government furlough, Dr. Michael Kirk, who was going to speak this evening from Goddard, was unable to get clearance to share some of that material from NASA because of the government shutdown. So You guys are stuck with me tonight, but I'm happy to be here and talk to you about getting started with astrophotography. It'll be a little bit of a crash course. And a lot of this is from my own personal experience or a lot of the online forums and channels and whatnot that I happen to frequent to, you know, learn and gain more proficiency in the hobby. If anyone has any questions, please go ahead and, you know, raise your hand or ask during the during the presentation. I want it to be a conversation and not just a monologue. I don't particularly like to hear myself talk. So please make it interactive. That said, let's go ahead and dive in and get started. A little control here. All right. So why astrophotography? I'm going to start off with sort of a personal statement. My personal thought is astrophotography is a complement to visual astronomy. The two coexist and they're there for very different things. Astrophotography is never going to achieve the kind of personal connection that you can get to the night sky from visual astronomy. It's just not. What we use astrophotography for is to complement that by enabling us to see things that we can't with our own eyes, no matter how big the telescope. And then also to take that data and either, you know, use it for scientific purposes or to make art. And Elizabeth can tell you about how those two diverge pretty quickly, but I do remember that talk. But that's basically what it's there for, right? And it does allow you to capture the experience to some extent and then broadly share it online. And I think one of the things that we can think about is the human eye and a CCD camera or CMOS camera see things very, very differently, right? So the human eye has a tremendous dynamic range. We can see amazing bright brights and amazing, you know, darks. And we have this ability to, you know, really kind of have this experience of floating in space almost when we look through a telescope. A CCD camera has an advantage over the human eye in that it can collect photons, light energy over very long periods of time. And that's its you know, major advantage here. And so what we typically do is optimize the equipment for astrophotography in a way that's going to allow us to track the sky very, very accurately over a long period of time, soak up that light, and then use that to form an image both at the telescope, but then also primarily after the observing night is over, the inside part, which we'll get into in some detail, which involves a lot of, you know, image processing. We'll just wait a minute. I don't know if you guys can shut the phone down. There's also an endless supply of new targets to capture. So once you've kind of crossed over to the you know, dimmer magnitudes, you'll find that the catalog of objects that you can take images of is really just quite phenomenal. So there's, you never run out of things to, you know, to image. In terms of a little bit of history here, milestones, the first photo of a celestial object was taken of the moon by John Draper, who was a New York physician and a chemistry professor, actually. If you squint really hard, you can kind of see that as a gibbous moon. I think it's actually quite phenomenal, though, that in 1840 they were able to take this image at all. This was with a daguerreotype camera. And if you all have seen pictures of people from the 1800s, you notice that they look very stern, right? Nobody's smiling in those photos. And the reason primarily was because it took so long to expose that film that people had to basically sit like a statue for tens of minutes or more in order to get that exposure. So being able to photograph the night sky was just a really big challenge back then. 10 years later, John Adams Whipple and William Cranch Bond successfully took an image of the star Vega. And so the idea here was now we're you know, kind of pushing the envelope in terms of faint objects that the rapidly evolving you know, emulsion on the plate was able to image. 30 years after that, you've got Henry Draper, and I did look this up. Henry Draper was John Draper's son, so there is a relation there. Produced the first image of a deep sky object, so that was the Orion Nebula. And the idea here is that, you know, now we're kind of crossing that threshold into being able to image things in greater detail than the human eye could see. And then from that point forward, a lot of scientific astronomy became photography based simply because of that exposure time. If we fast forward to the late 1970s, we have the introduction of CCD cameras. And there's kind of two main points here. One is that you got a lot cleaner, crisper, and sensitive performance out of a CCD versus film. And then also you've opened the door now to digital image processing, which is a game changer. Again, as we'll see from some of the tools I'll talk about later in the presentation. And then finally, 1990, the Hubble Space Telescope launches. And of course, as we all know, nothing I think in the history of astronomy has captured the public imagination like Hubble has. In terms of the imaging rig, there's kind of four main components to it I'll kind of highlight here. Obviously, the camera. I think my recommendation and that of a lot of people in the field is if you're getting started in it, and I'll not go into smart telescopes in this particular lecture. It's a different, I would say, genre of astrophotography. And there's another member of our community that's going to be presenting on that at a later talk. So we're looking at a system that is a modular astrophotography rig. So DSLRs or mirrorless cameras, which have kind of taken over from DSLRs recently, are kind of the starting point here, right? And the reason is that you can use them for daytime photography. They're general purpose devices. And the starting point there is getting used to using the manual settings on the device. So getting away from the auto exposure and the auto white balance and things like that. So you're not working with a point and shoot camera anymore, but now you have actually an instrument that you can configure manually. The show and tell table over here has a particular small refractor set up with a Sony mirrorless camera. And that's connected to the scope with a T2 adapter. We'll talk a little bit about that later. But basically, this is a good starting point, something of this general configuration. One of the drawbacks of the DSLRs is that they have infrared cut filters in them so that you're properly exposed and your colors are true to life in daytime photography. For astronomy, they're a little bit aggressive. So they tend to cut out a lot of that hydrogen alpha channel. And so some folks will have their cameras modded, right? They'll take out that IR cut filter. And you can put in a clip-in filter that's a little bit more, generous in terms of near infrared. But that's definitely a good starting point. If you progress in the hobby, the dedicated astronomy cameras are sort of your next stop, and there's a wide range of those. The red cylindrical looking objects that you see here on the table would be those dedicated cameras. The reason they're long and in that shape and they've got vents on the side is because they have cooling, right? They have active cooling. And by bringing the sensor down to freezing temperatures, they're able to reduce the dark current, right? Or the noise essentially that's caused by the thermal energy within the chip, the thermal dissipation on the chip. But they're optimized. They basically use the same sensors as the mirrorless cameras now. Sony makes the vast majority of them, but they are tweaked and tuned for astronomy purposes. Like I mentioned, they have different filters on them to use for astronomy. And they also have other types of optimizations. So there's many kinds of noise in that system, and one of them is something called amp glow. So newer cameras will basically manage the either through software that automatically removes that noise when the image is read out, or through optimizations of the hardware, they'll really cut that down so that these imagers are tuned for low light performance. Obviously, you've got a telescope. What I want to highlight here is that the astrograph, which is what we call a telescope that's optimized for photography, is generally different in terms of its optics and its design philosophy than a scope that's tuned for visual use. So these two scopes here are a little bit different. This one here is tuned as a photography device. It's a PETSful design. So it has many more pieces of glass in it than a typical visual astronomical instrument. And that's optimized within a very small package to expose that sensor quickly. It has a relatively wide field of view, so it's gathering a lot of light and concentrating it. And it also generates a very, very flat field. So you've got sharpness corner to corner on a large sensor that comes out of a device like this. The 91 millimeter scope here is a hybrid. That's designed for both visual and astronomical use. If you're using a small sensor, and that particular camera there has, I think, a micro four thirds sensor, so it's relatively small. That allows you to zoom in, and you don't need as much correction toward the edges of the field. If you have a larger sensor like APS-C, which is one of the newer standards, or full frame, which is similar to it, or exactly the same size as a 35 millimeter film, this particular camera here is APS-C size. So this is going to be larger, and as a result, it has this particular extension on it, right? This is called a field flattener. And as we get further in the talk, I'll explain specifically what that does. But this extra optic here, right, is needed to convert that visual telescope into something that can generate, you know, corner-to-corner sharpness on these stars for long exposures on that larger frame. You also notice that the telescopes for astronomical use tend to be smaller. And again, the reason is what we're doing is we're managing costs to a certain extent, right? So we put a lot of effort into creating as perfect an optical train as we possibly can. Obviously, to keep that within reasonable limits, that's going to be a smaller package, right? And what we're doing is we're saying, because we have a camera that can expose longer, we're basically taking advantage of that time integration. So less amount of light per second. But if you expose for 4, 5, 6 hours, even 20 hours over multiple nights, obviously, you know, you can get away with a smaller instrument, right? So you're really kind of biasing that design toward optical precision, and you're taking the penalty, if you will, right, in terms of time at the I was going to say the eyepiece, but at the rig. Last but definitely not least, and I have a tip here. Basically saying invest in a good mount and tripod first. I think a common mistake that a lot of folks make is they'll put a lot of money into the camera thinking this is astrophotography, I want a good camera. This is true, but I think that the better route there, and you'll save yourself a lot of frustration, is to take a camera that you already have and adapt it to a relatively inexpensive telescope and put your initial investment into the mount. The reason being that if you think about what's going on here in visual astronomy, what is a tracking mount for? It's to keep that object that you're looking at kind of in the center of the field of view. And if you have a relatively high magnification, that gets annoying, right? If the object keeps drifting out of the field of view. But that's about the limit of the precision that you need on the tracking. Just keep that object in that field. If you're taking images, right, over hours, what you need to do is ensure that this telescope is pointed with an accuracy that's better than one pixel on the image. So that's a much higher bar in terms of accuracy of pointing. So you want a mount that's going to be extremely solid, that's going to give you that precision in terms of tracking and facilitating auto guiding, and something that's definitely going to, you know, not vibrate when a gust of wind comes through, or when the telescope slews or something of that nature. So rule of thumb is ensure that your mount is solid, it's well-built, and that the payload that you have on it is no more than about half the rated capacity of the mount. Otherwise, you'll end up with a wobbly mount, and no matter how good your camera is, you're never going to get sharp images out of that. So the foundation is key. Yeah, absolutely. Which part? Sure. So the rule of thumb is when you look at the manufacturer's specifications for these, they'll have a maximum payload rating, right, in pounds typically. So what you want to do is ensure that the telescope, the optical train, the camera, everything that you see mounted on this plate, which they call the payload, is no more than half the rated capacity of the mount, okay, for this particular purpose. Again, if you're doing visual astronomy, it's not nearly as significant. I mean, certainly if you have a wobbly scope, that's annoying from a visual standpoint, but you can live with that to a far greater degree than if you're exposing for pixel accuracy. Go ahead.
What do you find the right balance of the weight for the payload to the number of finder scopes you have?
The number of finder scopes that I have. All right, so I'll explain what these are. Thank you, actually, for that question. So this is a harmonic mount. We'll get into the details of that in just a minute. But basically, what you see here are two telescopes above the main scope, right? The black telescope there is an optical finder scope, and you can see it's got the right angle rectifier on it. The reason I have that on there is because sighting Polaris and accurately aligning the telescope with that celestial pole is a process that we all have to go through. I want to expedite that as much as possible and get to the, you know, the fun stuff. So I happen to have that particular finder scope on there to sight Polaris very quickly and center it in the field as best I can before I go into a routine whereby the camera starts doing plates. So I have a camera in the computer, which is this red box. It's kind of hard to see because it's turned away from you, but there on this other finder scope mount is a red metal box. That's actually the computer that automates and captures the imagery. And so there's a plate solving routine whereby the computer looks at the image coming in through the telescope and matches it with a digital catalog of what's in the sky. And from that, it can deduce exactly where the telescope's pointed, what the field of view is, et cetera, et cetera. But you have to get a reasonably good alignment first, right? So this optical finder sights Polaris. You use your equatorial adjust, I'm sorry, your azimuth base adjustments to get that roughly aligned with that north celestial pole. And then you switch over to the automation, and then you start basically going through an iterative process of converging on near perfect alignment with Polaris. Again, the reason you want to do that is because you need that pixel level precision, right, in terms of your tracking. So that initial polar alignment is crucial. This white telescope here is called a guide scope. So you'll see there's a little red camera. And by the way, everything that's red on this, it's a signature color of a manufacturer called ZWO. They have an ecosystem of products that works well together. It's kind of like the Apple of astrophotography in the sense that, you know, all these pieces work really well. They're modular. The only limitation is you kind of have to stay within their ecosystem. So it's a trade-off. But anyway, so this sort of what they call a lipstick camera form factor that's in the guide scope is there to sight stars that are in the field of view of the main scope and maintain very, very precise tracking on those stars, right? So instead of relying on just a clock drive on the mount, what's happening is this camera is imaging the sky. It's taking the pictures of those stars. And as they move very, very slightly in the frame, it sends instructions to the motors and the mount to make adjustments to keep those stars, you know, from moving to an extent that it would blur the main image coming from the main camera. So that's what these two scopes are. All right. So going further into the mounts, again, if this is old hat, if folks are very familiar with this material, you know, please let me know. Trying to calibrate the material within the presentation is always a little bit tricky. But what you see here is a kind of a generic German equatorial mount. I mentioned before that, you know, the mount here is there to keep the telescope pointed and tracking the object you want in the night sky. In order to do that, you have to have this right ascension axis pointed at that north celestial pole. And as the sky rotates or appears to rotate, right, from our point of view, obviously it's the Earth that's turning under the sky. But as that appears to rotate, what happens is it all rotates around the axis of rotation of the Earth. So this is parallel to the axis of rotation of the Earth. The declination axis is at right angles to that. And so by moving in these two directions, these two degrees of freedom, you can point the telescope at any point in the sky and then relatively easily track it by simply making adjustments to right ascension. Now, in practice, because of the level of accuracy needed, you're never going to get this exactly right. So there are small corrections in declination as well that the autoguider makes. When you actually align the telescope digitally, this is from an app. There's several of them out there. They all kind of look the same. What they'll do is they'll take your position on the Earth and the current time, and they'll tell you the North Star is exactly here relative to the North Celestial Pole. This is what you actually want to align that right ascension axis with. So if you have a telescope with an optical viewfinder and a reticle, what you'll do is you'll look through that polar scope, as they call it, and you'll ensure that Polaris is on this particular point in the reticle so it matches your app. In this particular case, and I'll show it in a later slide, ZWO doesn't go with this specifically. What it has is that plate solving routine, and it has you iteratively take pictures and converge upon alignment with the North Celestial Pole. The harmonic drives are really kind of interesting. When I first started, the standard practice was to use a worm gear-based drive mechanism. And that resulted, this is just a pure mechanical mount here. That worm drive tracking mount that used to be kind of the standard was very large, right? The particular worm gear mechanism that they used was very precise. It had some periodic errors that were easily correctable. So it had a lot of, I think, positive attributes mechanically. But the problem with it was, again, the size, and you also didn't get a tremendous amount of torque out of it. So you had to very, very carefully balance the telescope on the mount. And then, like I said, use that periodic error correction to track accurately. What happened is since that, so I would say over the last decade or so, something called the harmonic drive design has come out. It uses a very different gearing system. The system's actually quite old, but it's just now making its way into this application. NASA used this as the transmission for the lunar rover, by the way, because they needed very high torque in a very small package. But what it basically does, without going into too much detail, is there's a deformable gear and an elliptical, what they call wave generator, that moves around inside that deformable gear. That gear has, I think, two or three teeth less, more or less than the outer surrounding gear. And as that wave generator rotates, it essentially sets up a type of resonance at a much lower harmonic frequency. So it looks like the gear processes inside of the larger housing. All of this is details that you probably don't need to know, but the bottom line is that particular design allows these types of mounts to achieve a gear reduction ratio of like 300 to 1. So that tells you you've got a fast motor spinning on the inside, but it generates slow but tremendous amount of force in a rotational direction. And so by having two of those in here, technically, I don't need this counterweight at all. I have them on here because this particular telescope with all the fire scopes and other items on it is near the limit of what the mount can handle without a counterweight. So I want to just, you know, lessen the strain on the system. But if you go by the manufacturer spec, you can actually mount a tremendous amount of weight for the size of the mount without that counterweight. Go ahead.
Harmonic drives, I've read a lot about them.
Sure.
Are they inherently more accurate than the...
It's a good question. So the short answer is no. The kind of errors that you get out of the harmonic drive are not as easily correctable internally as you do with the worm drive. It turns out that if you have an auto guider on the system, right, you can compensate for that pretty well. So you don't want to use this as a tracking mount by itself. You really want to connect it to an auto guider.
Okay.
So that's the trade-off. They also are more sensitive to polar alignment. So you want to make sure that you get a really, really good polar alignment.
I've got an iOpteron version of that.
How do you like it? Yeah.
I think I would have rather gotten that one.
The ZWO? Yeah. There's a lot of options on the market. Go ahead.
Yes. Does the harmonic drive require wind up and wind down, or can it just...
No. There's no backlash. Because of the way the gears are meshed, they're in like constant tension effectively. So there's no backlash compensation that's needed with the harmonic drive, which is really nice. All right, moving on to the optics. So you guys, I'm sure, have heard a lot about focal length, aperture, and speed. We're going to kind of debunk a little bit of the myths around the speed of a telescope, and I'll explain what that is in a minute. For those of you who are not familiar. So aperture is obviously the diameter of the main objective, right? So the mirror, the lens that you're using. There's two things that matter here. Obviously, the larger the aperture, the more light gathering capability or capacity that telescope has. Again, for astrophotography, not as important as visual, for the reason that we can integrate over time. So longer exposure can overcome that to a certain extent. But the diameter absolutely impacts the resolution of the scope, as it does for visual use. So because of diffraction, because light is a wave, for details that are kind of beyond the scope of this talk, the larger the aperture, the less of a spread in the point function that you get when you focus a pinpoint star or other feature on the image. So larger, you know, wider diameter gives you more resolving power. Focal length, the downside to it obviously is cost and portability, right? There's weight, there's size, there's cost associated with that. The focal length determines the overall magnification of the scope. It's important to remember that these two are essentially separate, right? So if I have a 91 millimeter scope and I have a 50 millimeter scope, and they're both, you know, the same focal length, the image that you're going to get out the back of that is going to be the same scale, right? The same amount of magnification. Magnification works a little bit differently in astrophotography than visual. I'll explain that in a sec. So that focal length is important in terms of, you know, how much zoom factor you get from the optics. The thing to remember, though, is that, and the same thing with visual, if you have too long of a focal length, right? Think of it like one of those old overhead projectors. You're spreading the image out larger and larger and larger. It's going to get dimmer. So the way to counteract that is to have a larger aperture. The larger the focal length you want to have, the larger the aperture you need to maintain a reasonable level of brightness in that image. That's kind of the relationship between the two. And the F ratio quantifies that, right? So a medium scope is going to be somewhere in the realm of like F5 to F7. That's kind of where you want to start when you're just using a general system and kind of getting your sea legs, so to speak, in astrophotography. If you pick too long of a focal length, with one exception, and that's the planetary stuff, what's going to happen is it puts more stress on everything, right? So more magnification means more accurate pointing is required. It means you need a larger objective to get a reasonable brightness. It means that your rig is heavier. Your mount accordingly has to support that. Everything in the system gets pushed to a higher level of performance in order to accommodate a higher focal length. And you really don't want to, you know, push that F number too high. On the other hand, if the F number is too low, and this is the speed trap, right? People will say, well, this is a super fast scope. You've seen these Rasa scopes from Celestron, and they've got like, you know, F2, F2.5. The problem with that is you have a light cone that is essentially kind of squat. So at the periphery of that light cone, you have a fairly aggressive angle of convergence on that light cone. And as a result, it's extremely difficult to get an optical train that can bring that image to focus across a large sensor. So as a consequence, these get very expensive, or you lose quality around the edges. This space cat, the mini space cat, is built like a tank. That's one of the reasons I got it. And it's cool, but it suffers from an issue of it's a fast lens. So the manufacturer's suggestion is to use a special type of digital AI filter to basically correct for stars at the periphery of the field. We can talk about that later. It's called Blur Exterminator. But the reason is, again, they were trying to go for what is the most portable, compact, equipment we can make. The compromise was that, you know, despite the superb optics that this company is known for, it's just really hard to get perfect correction at the periphery of that kind of a fast scope. So you need image processing to deal with that, to kind of pick up with slack. Now I'm going to get to this point, which is, if you remember the formula from visual astronomy, right, the magnification at the telescope when you're looking through an eyepiece is going to be the focal length of the objective divided by the focal length of the eyepiece. In astrophotography, you don't have an eyepiece typically, unless you're doing projection, but normally you're doing prime focus imaging. So the actual magnification that you get on the final image is a factor of not just the focal length of the telescope, but also the size of the pixels in the sensor. So you want to make sure that those two are reasonably matched, and we'll get into how to do that. But that's how magnification works in imaging. It's the size of your pixels and the focal length of your scope. The other thing is the fast scopes also are super, super sensitive in terms of collimation. That's not so much an issue with refractors, which is why a lot of astrographs are refractors, and also tilt. So these cameras all have tilt plates on them to basically allow you to make very, very minute adjustments to ensure you've got a perfectly perpendicular imaging plane to the optical axis of the scope. But again, the more aggressive that light cone converges, the more that's an issue. All right, so choosing your camera. There's a lot of choices here. I think the market is just absolutely overwhelming to somebody who's picking this up. And so I wanted to have a slide on this to kind of go through a couple of gotchas and kind of save you a whole lot of frustration. We already talked about the DSLR versus the dedicated, so I'm not going to go into that again. But in terms of sensor technology, you'll hear a lot of debate about color versus monochrome. All sensors are actually monochrome, right? They have photosites, they collect light. The electrons that get trapped as a result of that photoelectric effect don't know anything about color. They just know that electrons are getting kicked off when the photon gets, and so they're counting electrons, and that gives you a brightness effectively for that pixel. To achieve color, what one-shot color cameras do is they have what's called a Bayer filter, or there's actually other patterns as well, but that's the most popular. And it's just a mosaic of red, green, and blue micro lenses over the photosites on those images. I'm sorry, imaging sensors. The funny thing is, because of the mass production of color cameras, obviously most people want to take color pictures in one shot. These chips are actually cheaper to manufacture because of the mass production and the volume that they sell versus the dedicated monochrome that doesn't have the Bayer filter. So you're going to pay a little bit more for the monochrome camera. The way you get the advantage of doing that, though, is that you now have a sensor that's capturing unrestricted light, right? The sensor itself is getting all the photons that come in. And rather than having this matrix where you get, you know, red, green, red, green, red, green, and then blue, green, blue, green, blue, green, where you end up with twice as many green as red and blue pixels. And so your actual subframes in terms of red, green, blue are a fraction of the actual grid resolution of the sensor. The reason that green is twice as much as these two is because the human eye is most sensitive to detail and green. With a monochrome sensor, you don't have this. You get full resolution, red, green, and blue. And so there's no, you know, software interpolation. There's no other types of reconstruction required. You've got actual real data coming from the sky. And the way that you do this, obviously, you think about it, is you have filters, right? So for broadband imaging, you're going to have a red, green, and blue filter, and you take one image in red at full resolution, then you change the filter, one image in green, and then another image in blue. It adds a little bit of extra complexity, right, to your process. Some of that has been mitigated now with electronic filter wheels, but there's still extra steps within processing. The reality is this. This is my take. I think as a purist, the monochrome camera is going to give you better images. It's extra work. It's extra expense. The color cameras are super fantastic at this point. And again, talking about AI, AI is basically a lot of pattern recognition, right? So it's taking a lot of data and looking for patterns in that data to make a prediction of various sorts. And that prediction could be a decision. It could be a, you know, value of what's the stock going to be tomorrow. It could be, you know, what's the next word in sentence. So AI in this particular case actually is able to match patterns and reconstruct a better image than just straight interpolation from a one-shot color camera. So when you put all this technology together, the theoretical advantage of mono is kind of lessened. And so I would say definitely start with a one-shot color camera. There's also another benefit that has to do with filters that we'll get to in just a bit. Field of view, it's just the portion of the sky that the sensor captures at any one time. And again, it's related, or it's affected by the telescope's focus, obviously. But it's going to give you a fraction of that total field of view that the optics are providing. To save yourself a lot of trouble, I would definitely work with one of these digital planetarium software packages. You can get apps, you can get them on your computer. This one happens to be Sky Safari 6 Pro. And you put in all the specs for your equipment. So what these reticles are, these FOV rectangles, are showing you, this is the Orion Nebula, right? This is a horse head. And it's showing you what you would see for each one of these pairings of telescope and cameras. So the outer one is the Mini-Cat. That's a little telescope there with that particular mirrorless camera, which happens to be a Sony A7 R4, I believe. And then if you look at this inner one here, that's going to be the Fluorostar 91 with the APS-C camera. So that's the one that's standing up in the middle of the table. And the inner one is the camera that's mounted on the telescope itself. This is a 20 megapixel camera. This is a 26 megapixel camera. And this is a 26 megapixel camera. The actual sensor itself is full frame, so it's actually 60. And I could have drawn another rectangle that's even larger than that. But that particular telescope really is not well paired with full frame, so we use an APS-C mode.
So how large are these sensors?
I mean, they're the size of your thumbnail, roughly, right? If you've ever looked at a 35 millimeter film, that's the largest they get for consumer use. That's also pretty pricey. You start getting into like the $3,000 to $4,000 to $6,000 range for a full frame camera. APS-C, I think, because of the fact that that larger sensor means everything else has to be just more and more precise. And I'll illustrate that with this particular point. There's a ring in here, okay, sits between the, I'm sorry, field flattener and the camera. That ring is there to adjust the back focus, which is the precise distance at which this field flattener is designed to bring that, image to a flat focused field. With the APS-C sensor, right, this particular device allows you to adjust that back focus distance at tenths of a millimeter. So it's really, really sensitive, right? You got to get that distance exactly right. That's not such an issue with the PETSFOL design, but as your sensor gets larger, that becomes more and more crucial and more of a pain. The smaller sensors, you don't care, right? Because you're not worried about field flatness over such a large area. So the Micro Four Thirds, the smaller sensors, which is what you have in here, are more economical and easier to use. Obviously, the downside to them is you're imaging a smaller part of the scope, and you don't have as much dynamic range, although you can get over that with some other techniques. Like everything else, there's always a trick. But yeah, it's like the size of your, pick a fingernail, and there's a image sensor that's roughly that size. So once you plan this out, right, once you've said, all right, I want to image the Orion Nebula, right, this is going to tell you, okay, the mini cat's probably too wide. That particular configuration there is probably too tight. I'm going to go with the APS-C size sensors and the FLT91, the Fluorostar 91. So that tells me the pairing that I want to use roughly for this particular object I'm interested in. And then you want to determine, okay, not just the sensor size, but what resolution, how many pixels do you want in the camera once you pick the size? And this is where it gets a little bit tricky, right? So you might think, well, the more pixels, the better. Pixels give you more detail, but as the pixels get smaller and smaller and smaller, the system becomes noisier and you also lose dynamic range. The well depth is just not as large. So you don't have as many electrons that you can store, and therefore the range of brightness values that you can record at that pixel are not as large. A lot of these cameras will have a thing called binning. So they'll allow you to take, 2x2 matrix and treat those 4 pixels as one. So there's tricks in the hardware in certain cases to make a really high pixel camera act like it's lower resolution but larger pixels. And you set the binning amount, or you pick your camera based upon the kinds of objects you want to image, the kind of telescope you have. And this app right here at Astronomy Tools Calculator CCC Suitability will basically allow you to pick your telescope, pick your camera, and then determine on the spectrum whether or not the size of your pixel is matched to the optical resolution of your telescope. You don't want to oversample the image, and you don't want to undersample the image. There's artifacts associated with both. Okay, so now you've got your rig, you've got your camera matched to your telescope, you know what you're going to point the telescope at, you're ready to go out and actually start taking pictures. So now you've got to collect the light. The thing to think about here is integration and stacking. So let's say that the object you want to take a picture of will require an exposure of 4 to 5 hours, which is very typical. You don't want to take a 4 hour exposure, right? A single 4 hour exposure. A lot of things can happen. A cloud can come out in front of your field of view. A Starlink satellite could wreck your photo. An airplane could fly by. A gust of wind could vibrate your telescope. So any number of things could happen. And probably most importantly is you will saturate your sensor. So you only have so many bits of depth to play with in terms of the sensitivity and what's called the well on each one of those pixels. So you can only expose for so long before something bad happens. So what we do is, in order to achieve a 4 to 5 hour exposure, we take many subframes of shorter duration. This is kind of a Goldilocks problem as well. If I take too many subframes, then I do what's called underflowing the sensor, right? So I'm not collecting enough light to actually get differentiated values for brightness in the image. And so the quantization of my chip, everything in digital technology is based on quantization, right? It's not a continuous value, it's discrete steps. So if those steps, if the amount of light I'm collecting is so weak that it doesn't have a decent distribution over those discrete levels, I'm really going to like lose detail no matter how many pictures I take. If I have too long of an exposure, then you have the problems I just talked about before. So what works well for many systems is somewhere around 300 seconds, right? 5 minutes or so. That balances out a lot of different trade-offs within the imaging system. When you take these subframes and they look like this, right? For this, I think this is the Triangulum Galaxy. When you initially look through the app that's showing you the frames that you're acquiring, you might initially get kind of disappointed because you're like, I just put together this rig and I'm out here and I'm collecting light and this is the garbage that I'm getting. This is very disappointing. This is absolutely totally normal. This is a single subframe. The image has been, stretched, but not optimally. What you want to take is 40 of these, 50 of these, 100 of these. When you take these images and you stack them and you stretch the resulting value and you bring up that dynamic range because of the stacking, you get something that looks like that. Go ahead.
Why are you getting more information out of this? Presumably, if you take each sub, you're getting the same, 1 second or whatever picture. So why are you getting more information from the fainter parts of it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what we're doing is we're like adding values, right, over time. And as long as you have a reasonable amount of information in one frame, when you add them together, what's happening is you are increasing your signal to noise ratio. And the formula for that is 1/√ of the number of images.
I see. So the information is there,
It's there.
and they just and the software is written to sort of add it up, if you
That's
will.
right. That's right. Exactly. You're getting like pieces of the information. It's like a cake and you're stacking it
But
more.
the point is, something has to be there in the
That's
first
right.
place.
That's right. And that's what I was saying. If these subframes are too fast, if I took like a 2 second exposure, then essentially like I would have zeros and ones out of 65,000 levels of brightness. I would have like zero and one, zero and one. And so like there's not enough differentiation there to really stack. So I want to make sure that my subframes have at least some reasonable range, right, of values. It's nothing that's really impressive when you look at the image visually, one subframe. But when you stack them according to this algorithm, you start getting the detail. There's another technique. I don't want to spend time on it now, but it's called dithering and drizzling. So the mounts like this have the ability to sort of like jitter the camera sensor by a fraction of a pixel. And so what happens is if these subframes are slightly jittered, when the stacking software processes it, it creates a super resolution image, right? That's much larger in terms of the number of pixels and detail than any single frame. And Hubble does this actually. I think that was one of the first general applications of that technique. All right, so now we're collecting the imagery, but there's a problem, right? There's a problem that is kind of the bane of astronomy today in the modern world, and that is light pollution. So the filters that we initially came out for this were called broadband filters. We still kind of refer to them as broadband filters. The filters back in the day took advantage of the fact that nighttime illumination was typically limited in spectrum. It was from mercury vapor and sodium pressure lamps. And they happened to, fortunately, it's not shown here, but on this spectrum, they would have curves that were relatively easy to suppress and distinct from the frequencies that really were important to astronomers, right? So you had these broadband filters that had these sort of like very large sections and cutouts of where they let light through and where they blocked it. What's happened since then, unfortunately for us, is that the world has gone to LED lights. So now you've got light pollution at night that's broadband, right? Truly, it's spectrum, a continuous spectrum. And so what we try to do now is we say, all right, look, we can't block out as much of the light as we'd like, or at least we can't block it all out. But what we're going to do is we're going to limit drastically the amount of unwanted light that we let through to the sensor, and we're only going to focus on those narrow, I don't want to use the word narrow, but more tight bandwidths that are important for astrophotography. And so something like this is not a true narrow band filter, but it's not like the old continuous spectrum broadband filters either. What it's trying to do is create sort of like notches, right, in the spectrum, where it lets through some infrared, it lets through some red, it lets through green and blue-green, and then it lets through blue-violet. So it's missing a lot of the spectrum, but because color images are actually just made of red, green, and blue, I've got enough information in here to feed my primary colors in my display, and I can reproduce what looks like a full color image, even though I'm losing, you know, much of the spectrum. But again, the reason we do this is we want to get rid of as much of the light spectrum that's not really important to astronomy and is therefore just really, you know, light pollution that's getting into the sensor. This one happens to be the Antlia quad band filter. I recommend this if you're not using a filter wheel. These things are called filter drawers, and they're really awesome because you can just screw the filter into one of these drawers and then change it in the field without too much pain. It's a manual process, but if you're doing 3 hours with one filter and then 3 hours with another, it's not a big deal. Narrowband takes a different approach, and this was typically used with monochrome cameras only. So the idea was, if I'm looking at an object in the sky that is emitting light on only very, very narrow line frequencies, and this is basically emission nebulas for the most part and supernova remnants, then I'm only going to look at, you know, 3 to 5 nanometer band passes around those particular frequencies for things like hydrogen alpha, sulfur, oxygen, etc. It turns out that sort of these two have merged, right? So this used to be exclusively the province of monochrome imaging, and this used to be full color imaging. And what we have now are these new kinds of dual and tri-band filters. So instead of having one peak per filter, and you have a filter wheel and it does one element and then it rotates to the next filter, which exposes for a different element and so forth, you've got an element in the blue-green section, which is typically oxygen three. And then you've got hydrogen alpha typically, although there's another filter that's come out called L-Synergy, which does sulfur too. Why that's important is with two exposures, right? One in the red, blue-green, I should say the green and blue channels on your color camera, and one in the red channel, right? I now have the ability to separate out the oxygen and the hydrogen lines into two images with my one-shot color camera. So I'm collecting that in parallel. That's enough to create a close to Hubble type image in terms of the palette. If I use a new kind of filter called the Synergy filter that now replaces hydrogen alpha with sulfur, then I get a second series of exposures still with the color camera. I get more data in the oxygen. So now I've got two images with oxygen data, but I have a second set of images that now have sulfur too. So I can separate out these frames and now I have oxygen, hydrogen alpha, and sulfur. And if I combine those, even though it was done with a color camera, and I'll show you this, I'll jump ahead just real quickly. I can actually synthesize an image that looks like it was taken with a monochrome camera and is rendered with a Hubble palette. So again, that line between what you can do with a color camera and what you need a monochrome for is starting to blur more and more. It becomes an issue of purists. Okay, this is kind of a slide with similar information, but looked at it from the different vantage points. So we were talking about filters from the filter perspective before. Now we're looking at it from the deep sky object perspective. So what is the imaging technique, filters included, that you need to take good pictures of each one of these types of targets? So galaxies, they're broadband, right? You generally want to be in dark skies because broadband filters are not as effective at blocking light pollution. We know what a galaxy is. And it's going to emit that continuous spectrum. So we're going to use something like that quad band filter that I showed earlier. Reflection nebulae, kind of the same thing, right? With galaxies, it's a little bit of a mix. I've actually seen really great results by combining narrow band with broadband filters on galaxies, especially for the hydrogen alpha. You get that extra pink color in them. But reflection nebula, this is really the only way to go. You need that broadband.
So, Dark, so it's the reflecting nebulae are broadband.
Correct. Correct. They're molecular clouds, and they're just reflecting the continuous spectrum from their source stars. Absolutely. Dark nebula. These are essentially just massive clouds of dust and gas. In this particular case, they're blocking the background light. So you could have like an emission nebula behind them that's providing a background light source, and they're acting as this shadowy region in front of it. They look like silhouettes, and the horse head is the best example of that. The only way to go with that, right, is broadband because of the nature of the light reflection. And then emission nebula here, if you think about what these are, right, they're basically like neon signs without the glass. So it's ionized gas that's out in space. The gas is typically energized by primarily the UV spectrum of the stars, the young stars typically that are nearby. And so these emission nebulae are re-radiating that, right? They're taking that UV light and they're re-radiating it as visible light. But they're doing that in those very narrow line spectra that we saw earlier. So this is where you can use very aggressive narrow band filtering and get tremendous contrast on these nebulae, even from city light, even in the presence of city lights. So I took an image, which I'll show later on, from the top of a building in Washington, D.C. with terrible light pollution. You look up and you saw nothing. You saw like a gray sky. But what came out of that imagery was a really nice rendition of an emission nebula after 4 hours of imaging. And then planetary nebula is kind of a mix, right? So you've got the gas, you've got the outer layers of the star that's dying. They're off into space, and some of them are energized by that UV light from the white dwarf or the stellar core, and then others are reflecting the continuous spectrum. So you can get a mix
So
of imaging techniques there. Go ahead.
talk about the dark nebula. So
Sure.
basically, I mean, you're saying broadband, but in order to like see the horse head, you're actually imaging that in H alpha.
Yes. So it's it depends on what you're actually trying to image. If what you're looking for is, and these are really, really faint. So
Yeah.
typically what's happening is you've got a molecular cloud and there is actually detail in that. So you've got stars that are in the foreground that are actually, I mean, to some extent, they are reflection nebula,
Right, but
at
that's
least to
you're
some
talking
extent.
about
Yeah.
50 hours of exposure for some of
Correct.
those.
Correct. So there's lots and lots of time that you typically. And so these are complicated scenes where you're going to have emissive parts typically, or you have a reflection nebula behind it. You've got the dark
Emission
nebula in
nebula
front of
behind
it.
it.
Correct.
Yeah.
But I think the point here is like, in order to really get any detail in that dark cloud, you kind of need a broadband filter. You're not going to see detail in that
Right, but you also
filtration.
need to say that you're going up in your exposure
You are.
light
You are.
because the people who've figured
So
out that they could image dark nebula
I
figured out after doing 200 hours of.
Let me show you something. I'm gonna skip ahead real quickly. I'm gonna cheat here and skip ahead real quickly, just to show you this one thing. This is the Iris Nebula. I took this when I was actually about a month and a half ago when I was at the Shenandoah National Park. What you see in the center here is a reflection nebula, right? So you have this one very luminous star. This cloud at the periphery here, which you can barely see, is effectively a
The
dark
dark
nebula,
nebula, yeah.
right? But I had 4.5 hours of exposure on this, and I did a lot of aggressive image processing to reduce noise, and it's still tough to like really see it.
Right.
You would have to do 10, 20 hours of light collection to be able to see a lot of detail in the spot. Absolutely. All right, let's see. All right, so we kind of talked about the Hubble palette. I'm not going to spend a lot of more time on this unless there are questions. But again, I think Jay actually said at one point we were at one of those solar outreach events, and Jay was saying all color in astronomy is fake. And that's pretty true. So what we're doing here is, in order to bring out this magical detail, and this is the pictures that people look at in the books, right? And they think, wow, it actually looks like that. No, it actually doesn't. If you were to look at it, if your eyes were sensitive enough and you looked at this in true color, it would be extremely red because most of the energy is coming from this part of the spectrum. But in order to bring out the detail and also as a benefit, add some aesthetics to the picture, what they do is they take the sodium 2 line, which is the dark red, and they map that to red. They take the hydrogen alpha, which is a light red, and they map that to green.
Oh,
And then
really?
they take oxygen 3 and they map that to blue. So they're kind of shifting the spectrum to the left here. And when you do that, you get a false color image. I think in a lot of cases, personally, it's too green because the dominant is often the hydrogen alpha that gets mapped to green. So you've got to play with this and you don't necessarily mix them in equal quantities. But you do get some really pretty spectacular imagery by doing that trip.
So when Hubble palette is just how they map the different filters to the colors. And so you could really play with it. And since Hubble uses has 10, 12 filters, you could get any combination of three into the cup into your red RGB channels.
Yep. And the plus they go into the IR mode.
But that's
yes, they do.
Yes.
You're absolutely right. And actually, this looks even more strange, maybe. If you look at the James Webb telescopes, which is taking a lot of near-infrared wavelengths, they're doing an even more aggressive shift. And so the images look, I think, almost a little psychedelic. Everything they're
that
super
has
cool.
To be red.
Yes, exactly. Otherwise, it's all red. Right, exactly. So it's definitely a different view. Go ahead.
So we're talking about all of these broadband, narrowband filters.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
How much interference and overlap will they have with the Bayer filter of one-shot colors? And
yes,
when,
that's a very good
why
question.
Would they be preferable to have both of those filters in place?
That's a very good question. So the reason we use dual narrow band filters with a color camera, right, which has those red, green, and blue micro lenses on the photo sites, is because it's easy. So you are absolutely right in that what's happening is, if you think about it, if I have a Bayer matrix over a color camera, right, that makes it a color camera, and I have a hydrogen alpha filter, I'm throwing away, I'll go to the previous slide just to make it a little bit more. So I'm only letting the light through in this hydrogen alpha band, right, plus a little bit around the side. If you look at the frequency response for the red photo site with the red micro lens, it looks like kind of a weird, you know, like distorted bell curve. It's centered somewhere in the red, right? So what's happening is, of all the light that that red sensor could normally pick up, because it's a broadband micro lens, only that tiny sliver that's allowed by the hydrogen alpha narrow band filter in front of it is actually getting through to it. And its transmissivity is not 100%. So you're basically absolutely right. You're taking a light source, you're passing it through a very narrow band filter, you're taking that single line of light, and then you're passing it through another broadband filter, which is red. And so what's happening is you're getting a significant reduction in brightness. The only reason this works is because the quantum efficiency of those sensors is so high that you can still get a decent image even after losing all of that light. However, understand that that's happening. And so if you really wanted to shorten your exposure time, you would, you know, bite the bullet, get a monochrome camera, and then have a filter wheel, and then put that hydrogen alpha filter in front of the monochrome camera and expose full resolution with just that narrow band. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it's also long. If you just take a monochrome and stick a Bayer filter in front of it, you'll get basically...
Yeah, you get the same thing. Yep. I mean, if you want, there's nothing you can do with a color camera that you can't do with a monochrome camera if you have the right combination of filters. And you get a higher resolution and it's more efficient. It's just that now you're dealing with a filter wheel, now you're dealing with more images coming out of the camera. It's more expensive, it's a little bit more complicated. A
lot more expensive.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in some cases it can get a lot more expensive. So what's happened is that, like, yes, if you're willing to accept the inefficiencies from an energy standpoint, you can get images that look approaching what you could get with a monochrome setup with the filter wheel. But you're right, they're not as efficient. All right, so actually talking about convenience and trade-offs and so forth, now we get to why would anyone do this? It sounds like, to some extent, an insufferable process to go through building all this and collecting all this data. Is there anything we can do to bring down, you know, the complexity from the standpoint of the user experience? And the answer is yes. And so the reason that I went with this ZWO ecosystem, and again, people have different preferences, is you get modularity. You get the ability to choose, obviously, different cameras. You can plug and play different components. So you do have that flexibility, but you also have the benefit of an integrated ecosystem. And so that makes doing things like automating this workflow a lot easier. Not as simple as with one of the new smart telescopes, but again, you've got more options, more flexibility, a little bit more work. So it's kind of a compromise between the way it used to be and the new smart telescopes. I'm not going to go through all of this, but what I'm going to say is, like, the major steps in this flow. I talked before about, you know, the mount configuration. One thing I really would recommend is some of these new mounts have USB connections and power coming right out of the declination plate. So it used to be that you would have these cables that would like come down to the ground, right, and plug into your power supply or into a computer. And now you can have that computer there talking through a USB port that's right in the mount. So you don't have cables hanging over your right ascension axis. And then similarly, the power is coming right out of that saddle as well. Again, it's much, much better in terms of cable management, and it alleviates the problem of, worrying about snags. So I definitely recommend that in terms of going forward and buying a new mount, looking for that sort of built-in ports and declination plates. Focusing is surprisingly difficult in astrophotography, again, because your tolerance for out of focus is a lot less than it would be with visual. The human eye is great. It has the ability to take up some slack in terms of the sloppy focusing in the telescope, because obviously you've got a focusing mechanism in your eye. The camera does not have that. So you have to basically get a pin sharp focus from your rig, and you have to maintain it for a long period of time, right? Because we're doing these long exposures. So things like differences in temperature over the course of the night will expand or contract the telescope slightly and mess up your focus. Changing filters will change the focus slightly. Any number of events can cause the focus to change. So you can either use a tool like a Batinoff mask, and the next slide will show you what that looks like, or you have this kind of blocky thing here, which is an autofocuser, and it periodically electronically adjusts the focus. Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, I just had a question. You,
Yeah.
I'm a Mac person,
Yeah, I am too.
and I gotta learn all of this damn PC stuff because all this is
This
PC.
is Mac.
Well, SharpCap isn't.
No, so I have a Mac.
My question is, do you
Sure.
prefer SharpCap or Nina? I mean.
I'll tell you what my
Do
particular software load looks like. This
you
is a
remember?
Mac.
Yeah.
I run
Okay.
Cyril, which is a free piece of software. It doesn't work well for planetary, so I have things like SharpCap. I run them under Parallels, so you can run a
Okay.
Windows virtual machine on
Yeah, I've
Mac.
got Parallels too.
Yeah, and it actually has the window running in the Mac environment, so it doesn't
Yeah.
even look like you're
But you're
in.
still running your PC.
You're running a PC behind the scenes, kind of. But this software here is the ZWO software, so that runs on an iPad or an Android device. So you can control this whole thing from your phone or your
Yeah.
tablet. And then when you do the image processing, this is for the automation of the image acquisition process.
Okay.
When you take the imagery off, I use Cyril for the most part.
Cyril, I haven't
Yeah,
heard.
Cyril. It's free and it runs on Mac natively. And it's really, really active community, active development. It's relatively easy to use. But this is ZWO. So this is at the top, the polar alignment part. And you notice we have the happy face. I don't know if you can see it, a little bit of an eye chart. But there's a happy face, and it gives you these
Yes.
vectors of move a little bit to the right, a little bit to the left. What it's telling you to do, because this is not motorized, is you're basically adjusting the alt-az mount that the equatorial block is attached to. So this is basically getting that precise polar alignment, and it's doing that with plate solving inside the software and telling you how to move the telescope to get that perfect alignment. The shooting schedule, right? So once you've got the focusing, which we talked about, the mount configured, the polar alignment, the target acquisition, there's a sky catalog that then allows you to slew the camera to the right place, or slew the telescope rather to the right place. But now you have to actually gather the data, and you have a shooting schedule. So it makes it relatively easy. You have these different types of frames that you can capture, and you say, I want to capture 40 images of this object, 300 seconds each. I want to do drizzling or not drizzling, yada yada. And then after that, I want to do, or if you have a filter wheel, you could say, I want, so many images with this filter, then change the filter setting, so many images with that filter. So it automates that process. You can also schedule darks and biases and flats. And we'll talk about what those calibration frames are in a minute. But it makes it much easier because once this thing is programmed, you can let it run for 4 hours, which allows you then to go do visual astronomy while your astrophotography rig is collecting its photons. You don't want to babysit that. Go look through a real telescope.
Or you can
So,
sew.
go
So
ahead.
when you're doing
that stuff, is this on your cell phone you're trying
That's
to?
on your cell phone.
Oh my God, I can't, my fingers are this big.
You can get a tablet. It'll run on the tablet too. Or if you have a new Mac, it actually will run this on a Mac. So you can have your Mac. But
I'm not gonna buy a
one of
Mac.
the things I liked about this though is back in the day you had to have like a full-size laptop with you, and that was just kind of a pain, the power supply, all that. The new stuff will run on a mobile device, which is more convenient, in a way. So that's that. And so then you start running. There's one thing we didn't really talk about, which is auto guiding. I'm not going to deal with that. That's kind of an advanced topic, but basically this little inset here, or little sub window, is showing you the accuracy of your right ascension in blue and your declination guidance. Ideally, you want to keep this within 1 arc second, and this will tell you how your mount is doing. But there's a calibration step. You tell it to go start guiding. It pops this up, and then you don't worry about it. You let the system take care of the guiding for you. And you collect all your images. And again, this is actually the Iris Nebula. So these are my picture, or this one definitely is mine. You can see that single frame. It's enough to tell you it's there, but it's not a particularly fantastic, image that you get while you're collecting. The real detail, as we discussed before, comes later with the stacking. But even so, it's pretty exciting to see that object as faint as it is there. Something amazing is happening. You're collecting photons from, light years away. This workflow deep dive will focus on the focusing and the guiding. This is the Batinoff mask. So these particular telescopes are interesting. The reason they have this cat branding, you notice, you see there's a space cat here because it's gray, but there's the cat with the space helmet. The reason this happens is because this whisker, right, is from the Batinoff mask. So it's an interesting diffraction pattern that produces on bright pinpoint objects like stars, these particular diffraction spikes. And it turns out that when you're out of focus, the middle spike is either off to the left or off to the right or off to the left. So you know you're in focus when you've got a perfect alignment of those whiskers. And those whiskers are on the cat, and so it's a marketing thing. What can I say?
Yeah, my EVs, my Unistellar EV scope
Yeah,
has one,
it's built
and
into
they
it.
tell you to use it before each time.
Exactly. And it's so much easier than trying to eyeball the
Yeah.
stars. It really works well. It's surprising. I think we already talked about dithering and how that actually allows you to slightly offset the pixels during subframe collection. And so when the camera's software, sorry, when the processing occurs on the camera frames afterwards, what you get is that super resolution image as a result of the dithering process. We're getting to the end of it now. So image calibration. So in addition of taking pictures of the thing you want to take a picture of, right, what we call the light frames. It's best practice to basically capture these other types of frames as well. There are things called bias frames. These things are relatively painless. You can do them without having to really wait or do any particular process steps or anything like that. All you do is you tell the scheduler in the software, I want to take a whole bunch of bias frames. And what it basically does is it auto sets the exposure. It's a very, very short exposure. And what it's trying to do is it's trying to grab a particular kind of noise out of the sensor called readout noise. So every time the sensor flushes the pixels, right, there's a certain amount of electronic noise in the system that occurs as a result of that transfer of electrons out of the gates or out of the wells into the analog to digital converter. So this basically measures that, right? It takes a picture of the internal noise of the readout in the camera, and it uses that to factor that out of your final image. So that's helping to clean up the image. The dark frames are there to capture a different kind of noise. It's called dark current or thermal noise. We talked about how these cameras have cooling systems. So this is a thermoelectric cooling system. There are two stages, and they, in a solid state fashion, basically reject heat from the imaging sensor and dissipate it into the environment. So they cool that sensor down to below freezing. That dramatically removes a lot of dark current in and of itself, but there's still more there. So what we do is we take pictures of the same length and under the same temperature and other conditions as the light frames, but we put the lens cap on. So we take pictures with the lens cap on, and what you get is a picture of this thermal noise. So now you've got the dark frames. This particular process doesn't show the bias frames, but it's basically the same process. You get a master bias and a master dark, and you subtract them from that image. And then you get flat frames. These are a little bit of a pain because what you're doing is you want to basically get a picture of the vignetting that's, or the darkening around the corners that's endemic to almost any optical system. If you have dust or some imperfection in the optical system, it'll create a shadow. You want to get a picture of that shadow. And so that flat frame is taking a picture. The temperature is not super important. It's really about the optics of the system. So there's many methods to do it. If you have money to throw away, you can spend $400 on a little panel that you can fit over your telescope in the field and take flat frames along with everything else. Not worth it, in my opinion. The easiest thing to do is to throw a t-shirt on the telescope, put a rubber band on it, and stretch it taut like a drum, and basically take your flat frames. And what will come back is an image that's got, like I said, a little bit of shadow from dust, and it's got like the vignetting and whatnot. These frames are combined, take many of each kind, they're combined into masters. And you actually divide your calibrated image by the master flat, and that normalizes all of that variation in the light field.
On the flats,
Yep,
the dust shifts around.
yeah.
You need, say, you need more than one side ever?
You need, so because dust is dynamic, you could have fingerprints on the filter or any number of things. In theory, if you had perfectly clean optics, what you would want to do is you would want to take one master set and keep it on your computer for each combination of camera and telescope. Okay. I would say periodically update it because, you know, again, if
You
dust
get
gets
dust,
on it, now you've got that.
yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's rotation relative to the scope.
Yes, that's true. If you're rotating the camera, the field rotation.
Sure.
I'm sorry, Jay, and
I
then.
was going to say for the your flats,
Uh-huh.
you can also take a picture of the sky.
Yes. Yes.
You know, at certain times of the day
That's true.
when the sky
That's true.
is flat.
But that's definitely true. You can this particular method only works if you have a uniform field. So you put the t-shirt and point it at a clear sky. That works too. That works too. I'm sorry, Jerry, you had a question?
So yeah, it's about basically how often you know maintain this. Is it a, does is it affected by the temperature, ambient temperature that you're in as well?
So that's a very good question. The dark frames are. So if you want to take the dark frames in situ. So what I always do is I take like, I calculate. So if I'm taking 300 second exposures, right, 5 minutes, then I calculate in the equivalent of like 10 to 30 dark frames in the field under those conditions. And I save that as, I schedule that as part of my automated image collection. So those have to be at the right temperature as your light, the same temperature as your light.
But won't the sensor change temperature throughout the entire exposure?
No,
No, because the cooling system actually keeps it at the same temperature.
you set a cooling, you set a temperature
You
on
set a
the,
temperature on the cooler.
oh, so you can control
Yeah.
that.
Yeah. So that active cooling system is like a thermostat built in, and it keeps that sensor at a constant temperature. Now it's limited, but it's actually pretty powerful. So if you had a massive change in your ambient temperature and the cooler wasn't effective, able to maintain that, it'll actually set an alert and say, "Hey, I'm outside my thermal limits."
If you've got a DSLR and
Yeah.
the you know they have no temperature control.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And
So
it's really amazing the difference in
it really is.
what you see
It really is.
hot cold.
So you live with it if you have a DSLR. Anyone else? Nope. Okay. I love the fact though that like we've got all of this technology, and yet the t-shirt method is like one of the most important steps in the whole process. Okay, so now we're gonna get into the inside portion, right? So we're done collecting all of our imagery in the field. We're bringing it in, and we're doing a ton of data reduction and processing on it. So the two stages, image stacking and calibration, already talked about that. So we're good to go there. And now image processing. So when you have your stacked and calibrated frame that comes out of that processing we just talked about, what you typically do, and this is Cyril, by the way, Jay, so this is a Mac program, free. You run something called StarNet. And StarNet looks at the image, and it uses what's called discriminating AI to find everything in the image that looks like a star. And it takes it out, and it uses context-aware software to like fill in the hole left by the fact that you pulled the star out. So you end up with something that looks pretty amazing. It's the picture of your nebula with no stars. The reason you want to do this, and then you've got the star mask over there. The reason you want to do this is because a lot of the processing that you do, the wavelet processing, the color correction, the stretching, et cetera, you want to do that on the gaseous nebula separate from the stars. If you apply the same filters to both these objects, you'll end up with kind of crappy stars at the end. They may be off color. They may be like have artifacts, halos around them, and all sorts of other problems from the ringing associated with wavelets. So you really want to pull that star mask out and then process that separately, and then do your narrow band or other type of recomposition with the starless image alone. Once you've got these where you want them, you stretch them, you wavelet process them, you maybe apply deconvolution, which is a way of, the software knows a star is a pinpoint. When it's imaged, it's an airy disk. Maybe it has some other blobbiness associated with it. So the software applies this inverse blur function where it says, I'm going to map this blob to the star that I know it's supposed to be. And then it applies it to the whole image, and it gets a remarkable sharpening effect that only works for astronomical images because stars are special things for digital signal processing software. Anyway, so you're done with all of that. And then you take it into like Photoshop or Lightroom. So you're out of the astronomy specific software. You've also gone from probably 32 bits per pixel down to about 16 or 8 at this point. And this is really cleaning it up from an artistic standpoint. So you're adjusting your curves. You're maybe putting masks on this and selectively sharpening some parts of the image and not others. You're applying a lot of histogram stretches and so forth. You maybe want to bring out the blue, a little bit of purple, but not the red. So this is the aesthetic cleanup in Photoshop, and you've got your final recomposed image. I've got one slide on this. It would be an entire lecture all to itself, but planetary imaging is kind of taking a lot of what I just told you and throwing it out the window.
Yeah.
So I'm going to just go through this very, very quickly. You've got here these different aspects of the process, and then the deep sky stuff we've already talked about, and then how planetary, lunar, and solar, for that matter, is different. So with deep sky images, you've got long exposures, right? Minutes to hours. With planetary imaging, think about what you have. You don't have a relatively extended, super faint object. You have a very, very tiny object that you need to have very high magnification on, but it's very bright, relatively speaking. So what you want to do is high-speed capture, not long exposure. There's a technique called lucky imaging that says, if I take 1,000 images, a few milliseconds each, of the planet, some fraction of those, by chance, will be taken when the atmosphere at that moment was relatively stable. The rest of the images are crap. So the software takes a lot of images, and it then analyzes the quality of the images and throws out anything but like the top 200 frames or whatever. The optics, right? We just got through talking about why you want wide field refractors when you're starting out with DSOs. That's true. Unfortunately, these types of telescopes are not going to do a whole lot for you when you're taking pictures of planets. You have two choices here. You can either get a really big refractor that's going to cost a lot of money, but delivers beautiful imagery. So this is 91 millimeter. You're talking about going up to at least 132 or 150. I cheat to a certain extent. I haven't done a whole lot with it. I have a camera here, the much smaller camera, much cheaper, but it has tiny, tiny, tiny pixels. So it's able to extract detail at the absolute optical limit of that system. So that's one option, is to use tiny pixels. But you're looking at either a high focal length refractor, large objective, or a Schmidt-Cassegrain or Mach telescope. You can also use a Barlow or a PowerMate. But keep in mind, when you use these, you're not increasing your aperture, so your resolving power is no better. All right, you're set up. Equatorial mount, we talked about how oh, this tracking, this auto guiding, all of this stuff here has to be like 1 arc second of accuracy. It's got to be pixel perfect for hours in terms of tracking. With planets, I don't care. I can actually get away with an azimuth because if I'm taking a picture that's only a few milliseconds in length, the planet's not going to appreciably move across the field of view during that time. The only problem there is that it does drift. And so unless you want to manually do this between exposures, which is not really practical, some sort of tracking mount, but you can get away with a lot more slop on the tracking with a planet. In terms of filters, you don't care. Light pollution is really not a factor with planetary images. You can put in special kinds of UV filters in certain cases, either to cut the UV out, UVIR cut filters, either to get rid of the UVIR, or in some cases, you actually embrace the IR because IR is more robust to seeing conditions. So you get a near IR image of a planet in bad seeing, and it comes out better than visible. But what you really want for planetary imaging at low altitude is it turns out if you have a bright disk and it's lower on the horizon, the atmosphere itself acts like a prism. So it causes an effect, there's an effect called dispersion, right, or color fringing. And there's a very clever device that contains a prism inside that applies the inverse dispersion to what the atmosphere is doing. And it can give you significantly higher quality images of planets coming out of Schmidt-Cassegrain telescopes in particular.
What was that?
Go ahead.
Is it a fixed thing or is it?
It looks like a Barlow with these two like spokes sticking out of it, and those rotate prisms inside the device.
Oh, so you can manually.
You manually tweak it, and there's a process by which you kind of trial and error get the setting just right. Mm-hmm. But again, the whole point of it is to counter correct for that atmospheric dispersion with the inverse dispersion.
That's the thing that makes things like Mercury look.
Correct.
Red on top and blue on the bottom.
Right, exactly. And that happens when it's low on the horizon and you're getting that prism effect from the atmosphere. That's exactly right.
It's also the cause of the green flash.
That's right. Yes. And often it's used with aliens. In terms of capture, right, when you're looking at long exposures and deep sky work, the camera, you want to look at something which is high quantum efficiency, low gain. It's all about low light, right? You're trying to collect light that's barely even there. This is not an issue with planets. In planets, what you really want to do is get a camera that has a very, very high image bandwidth so you can collect, hundreds of frames a second, right? As opposed to one frame every 5 minutes, now you're collecting 300 frames a second. And there's special software and there's some cameras that allow you to select a region of interest. So you don't even expose the whole sensor. You're just exposing and reading in hardware from a tiny tile within that sensor. And that ups the frame rate. And finally, the software I mentioned before, like Deep Sky Stacker, Cyril, PixInsight, these are all Deep Sky astrophotography specific packages. With Planetary, it's a different set entirely. So SharpCap is kind of king of the hill. I happen to use Auto Stacker, and then you can use sharpening with Registrax or a couple other different tools that really apply algorithms which are specially designed for planetary use and bringing out subtle details within, like the bands of Jupiter's clouds. Okay, so wrapping up. So it's a journey. The three things to remember are precise capture. So what do you need for that? You need the tracking mount to be high precision. You need to get the right telescope for the job. Again, I would suggest for most deep sky work, start out with a wide field quality APO refractor. Essential calibration. So cameras, as amazing as they are, and they've gotten way, way better, you still want to help them out by doing those calibration frames. I think at some point, all of this stuff will be done within the camera itself. So smart telescopes are starting to do this sort of correction internally, but there's a limit to what you can do automatically in a real-time capture situation. And then creative processing, right? Ultimately, a lot of this work, at least for us as hobbyists, who are not, having a scientific end to this, process, are really producing art. So have fun with it. And use these tools to get the subjective effect that you think best represents your experience under the sky. And a surefire way to get frustrated is to expect everything to work on the first try. Understand that, like, you're going to have a lot of small failures. So celebrate the small victories. The glass is half full. And remember that the process of learning is part of the, you know, the reward. Along those lines, I have had situations where I went out with this rig and I realized I couldn't see a thing. I had forgotten a headlight. You know, sometimes for visual astronomy, you get like a red light you strap to your head. And because your eyes are not being dark adapted with this, right, you're imaging rather than observing in this case. A camping light is a really fantastic accessory. This thing has a telescoping head on it. You can rotate that head, put it on the telescope, and you can ensure that you've got visibility into the controls for polar alignment and focusing and so forth.
What's that point in what you're talking about?
This device right here is a camping light. So it's an LED. It has many sets of brightness levels. You can adjust the color temperature of the bulb. I think these things are have magnets in them, so you can actually attach it magnetically to any ferromagnetic surface. But it's a camping light. Yeah, sure.
We're all trying to figure it out. So it's kind of shielded. That's nice.
So you can actually rotate the head.
Those are pretty red, though.
No, you can put a manual, like you can cut out a gel filter and put it in part of that, and you can get red. But again, if you're doing astrophotography, right, you're not really looking through the telescope here. So your own dark adapted vision is less important than your ability to see what's going on with the filter and electronics and all that business. Again, if you're going to do what I suggest, though, and you set this up and let it run for the whole night, and you've got a visual telescope, enjoy the stars while this thing is collecting its data. At the end of the day, the goal here is, I think, to see the things that are, I go back to what I said before. When I was taking that one image of the Heart Nebula, I was just blown away by the fact that I had this ability to extract a picture of this hanging over, and it's actually quite large. It's the size of several full moons, hanging over our heads in the middle of DC, completely invisible to anyone looking up with their own eyes. But, you know, with this rig, you can extract a picture like this from a city center. I was just blown away by that. This is just some of the other work I've done. You mentioned the Iris Nebula before. That was Tsuchishan Atlas, right? The comet a year ago in November. And then, of course, the solar chromosphere. I will make a comment on this. This is a type of, this is broadband reflection. This is narrowband emissive broadband. This is very, very, very narrow band. So the hydrogen alpha filter you use for that picture is not like the deep sky hydrogen alpha. Do not use a deep sky hydrogen alpha to try and take a picture of the sun. This is a completely separate telescope. And if you've seen it, if you 6.2 come out. And we're at, right. So whereas these narrow band filters are like 3 to 5 nanometers, that filter band pass is measured in angstroms. It's absolutely tiny. But with that, right, and it's a different type, it's not a thin film, it's an etalon. So it's two mirrors that bounce light back and forth to do the interference, destructive interference. But you can get really fantastic images out of it. Go ahead.
Is the solar photo stretched horizontally because of the rotation of the sun?
Is it what?
It's
why is it oval?
Oh, because when I was a little bit sloppy when I put this together, and so it's either the
stretched it.
Right. So it's either stretched it. In the frame. I don't think it really is because on my screen it looks pretty circular. I'm thinking it's the projector.
Yeah.
That's basically warping it a little bit.
Yeah, it's circular there.
So
yeah.
The sun is really not like that.
The sun's not oval, it's a circle.
But you cheated because you changed the color.
I did. So there's two things that are going on here. So remember that all narrowband images are actually monochrome. So this is hydrogen alpha. It's a grayscale image when it comes out. I've inverted that because I think, honestly, I think it's more dramatic. And this is a common technique with solar is to change black to white and white to black, except for on the periphery of the sun. So it basically adds a lot of detail to the prominences, which otherwise would kind of get lost in the glare of the center.
And then also it's colorized. And it's not just one color, but you have what's called a color map. So the darker shades are a deeper orange or red. And then as you get brighter, the color shifts actually to kind of follow a a black body thermal radiation curves.
Right. Nebula, were you using narrowband filters on that separately? Or was that just with the color camera?
No, so this is...
the hard nebula.
The hard nebula. Yeah. This is, all of these are color cameras except this. This is a monochrome special solar camera for that purpose. But this is a color camera with a dual band filter. So you're looking at a combination of hydrogen alpha and oxygen three.
Okay.
And then these are broadband.
Yep. Anything else? All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your assistance.
So I'm just going to jump.
I'm going to test it out.
So I've also been doing astrophotography for a long time, but I learned a long time ago that sometimes the easiest method is the one that you use, you know, what you use most is usually. So if you have a cell phone, you can actually get some pretty good pictures with your cell phone, like constellations and stuff. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of having a tripod and a little adapter that you can put your phone onto, and then you can get some really good pictures. It's much cheaper than that.
Start out that way. Start out that way.
Much more forgiving when you're dancing around it, you know? Like, yeah. I have a bad habit of doing. I have messed up so many pictures by accidentally kicking the tripod or something. So much more forgiving.
Absolutely true.
Five different computer
Yes. Yes, absolutely true. Yes, Jared.
Talking about the cloth, I don't know if they've gone the other way around. That is that with all these iterations of technologies that basically were only at a commercial level, how is it for the technology that's in ground observatories for adaptive optics?
So believe it or not, you can buy adaptive optics modules for home telescopes. They're expensive, but they do exist.
Yeah.
I would say, I mean,
do they use actual lasers then?
No,
I think they're just doing image processing.
Yeah,
right?
I think it's an image processing
computer thing that's doing.
So the ground control is laser systems.
Well, think about it, right? So, I forget the name of it, but the deconvolution filter, right? That's applied in image processing. So in Cyril, you get a number of different tools. One of them is deconvolution. Wavelets is one, etc. The deconvolution is basically saying, I have this blob, right? And I know that it's a star, and I know what stars look like. They're point sources. So what mathematical function do I need to apply to this image to convert it from this blob to this the point source that I know it is? So the active optics system, right, or adaptive optics system, is kind of doing that in a sense. You only need the laser if there's no suitable star for the software to process. But we're not, I mean, this isn't a 200-inch telescope, right, at Palomar, that's like imaging a tiny, tiny section of the sky. So there's always stars in the field of view that are suitable for.
The lasers are just creating an artificial
star
in the atmosphere for the telescope.
I'm sorry, the bush here.
Lasers who have to coordinate with the FAA and
yeah, I'm thinking
safety observer.
Yeah, Hawaii.
It's exciting sodium atoms, right? That's
yeah,
atmosphere
yeah.
And creating a star.
Yeah. Sure. Kind of a broad question I'd ask.
Yeah.
Got the same thing. So if you don't have a telescope, what is like a good, example or a good way of going about having a good scope and, you know, camera combination about how much would it cost? Where would you go? Like Amazon?
Sure.
You know,
Not Amazon.
No.
Not Amazon.
I mean, actually, a lot of the stuff is available on eBay. What I would do if I was just starting out, like I said, is
AstroMars.
Yeah, AstroMars.
Absolutely. You can pick up used stuff there.
Yeah. So a lot of this software is free. What I would do is if you're going to start out, I would start out with something relatively large and bright, like the Orion Nebula, right? That's a good starter object. You can take a telephoto lens that you may already have, or you buy a tele, like 135 millimeter lens. You can get them for a couple $100. Manual focus, you don't need autofocus on it. Yeah. And then
take a camera that you already have. I mean, obviously, Elizabeth is showing like to really start out, use your cell phone, right? That's just a, and actually some of these are really amazing because they'll do long exposure on the phone and you can get beautiful shots of the Milky Way galaxy and whatnot. You just need to go to a dark sky site because you don't have the narrow band filters and that kind of thing. But I would do a 135 millimeter lens that is going to look in general form similar to this. You can get a star tracker, which is not going to have the auto guiding and all of that, but it's going to have like the ability to track the rotation of the Earth, which is suitable for wide field, really, really wide field views.
Right.
That's a few hundred bucks you can get on Amazon, eBay. Go ahead, Jared. Do you have a suggestion?
Presentation.
Yeah.
Do some of the different
And use a mirrorless or a DSLR camera. So
specific technique.
you're probably talking, you know, like it's less than 1,000, like 500 bucks
Right.
probably for the whole
I
pack.
guess I wondered if with all the technology, they sell it all together or something.
Well, it's so that's the smart scope, right? So
Yeah.
Guy has a fully integrated from ZWO, the same manufacturer that makes this, has an all-in-one smart scope. And you don't have to worry about putting any of this stuff together. You pull it out of the box, you set it up, you go through your app, right, to
Yeah,
execute
the
this
C
workflow.
star. Yeah,
you can't
C
change
star,
them. He's got a C
yes.
star. I've got a Unistellar
A
EV.
Unistellar,
Yes.
yeah. So those are more integrated. So that's kind of taking this where you lose the modularity, but you get a super simplified workflow. Go ahead.
I'm kind of curious, like with the C star and Unistellar, the one thing that I kind of had against them is that what happens as you know, as the technology ages and the cameras age, you can't replace them,
Right.
right? Whereas here, as technology improves and you get newer cameras, you can just, the
Swap it out.
optics don't change.
Right.
You just swap out the camera. And in fact, any he could swap out any of those
I think
cameras.
Unistellar, I think you can
You can
do
change the.
fiddling around with
Well,
it. Yeah.
the C Star is 500 bucks.
Yeah.
Right.
And
Yeah.
for a DSLR used camera, you can easily spend
Right.
500 bucks. So
Right.
it's
And
Yeah.
your deep sky cameras on here are costing how much?
I mean, they're a lot more than 300 bucks.
Yeah. Exactly.
So,
You know, so
yeah,
what do you want to accomplish?
that's exactly
Yeah.
right. That's exactly right.
You can go on the
What
short
I would
area.
say though is, and this is it, like if you go right to, I put this out on the table, and I'm glad you asked the question because I want to make this statement. I'm not suggesting people go out and buy this right now. The reason I brought the show and tell was to show you the range of options of things that exist. I would not say go out and get this if you're starting out in the hobby. I would say get a C Star for 500 bucks and play with that and see if it's something you really like. And then what happens is as you develop or choose to continue or not, you have all these options, right, to kind of progressively grow in the hobby. Good.
Yeah, something like a question between these two steps that listen showed only have. What about the cell phone mouse attached to the eyepiece of telescope?
Yeah, that's a good question. So for like lunar imaging or planetary images in particular, and some really bright things like the Orion Nebula, what happens is there's something called projection photography. So instead of attaching the camera directly to the telescope where you have only the objective optics, right, that are coming through here and forming an image, a direct image at the image plane, you have an eyepiece, right? It's a visual telescope. And what's happening is there's this little adapter. I actually have one in the car that allows you to take your cell phone and then put that cell phone over the eyepiece, just like she's right, just like that.
Yeah.
And so
And some
that will
people,
allow you to get an image by hand.
some
Yeah,
people's hands are steady enough that they
yeah,
can
mine
move the
aren't
tube.
Yeah,
They
I can't.
could.
A surgeon's
Just
hands.
get pictures of
Yeah.
Saturn
Yeah.
with Titan's shadow by holding my cell phone up to where
The
the
telescope.
pieces
Yeah,
of the telescope
that
over
would be
here.
pretty.
I've got an essential tremor.
Okay.
I can't do anything.
You'll see
I
the
can't even.
story.
But yeah, they have these little universal adapters. So what they
Yeah,
actually
I've
do
got
is
one.
you've got one, yeah,
Yeah.
they clamp onto
Right.
the
Yeah.
focuser tube and
Yeah.
then they mount the
No, I
eye.
don't worry about
Yeah, thank
the
you.
technology getting outdated.
What's that?
You can just swap out the phone or another one.
Yeah, it's true.
I
It's the one thing I will say is like you
Yeah.
do there is a difference, particularly with low light performance, between the larger chips and the cell phone chips, right?
Under the pinhole lens and
Correct. So that's the trade-off is when you have really, really tiny pixels, which cell phones have, you're going to get additional noise and your dynamic range is not going to be as high. So again, it's trade-offs with everything.
But it's amazing
But
what
it
they
is
could do.
amazing how far that tech has come.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
One question,
Sure.
with all the processing you're doing, is there some possibility that you're introducing artifacts?
Good question.
Yeah.
Good question. So this is a huge debate right now in the community. There are purists who are like, I don't want anything to do with AI tools. Like Photoshop is bad enough.
Yeah, right.
So here's my take on it, right? I think there are sets of tools out there that are called discriminative AI as opposed to generative AI. Generative AI produces content. Discriminative AI does not, right? It's
Yeah.
basically looking to clean up what's there. So I personally like will use AI for things like noise reduction. It's very, very effective at noise reduction. I draw the line personally like at upsampling where it's trying to use AI to add detail to the
Okay.
image, right? That's not actually there.
Yeah.
Again, if what you're trying to do is art, that's maybe fair game, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're trying to
But you're
produce
trying
a
you
work of
don't
art.
you gotta be careful.
JWST and
JWST.
Hubble are pretty
It's funny, it's
playing
all
around with the
different
images.
processing. You're not
Yeah.
doing some stuff
Okay.
that
Yeah.
isn't there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So
Exactly.
you're not.
That's why I wanted to make
Yeah,
sure.
no.
Paint,
Sure.
to be
But
honest.
what you will do in science, though, is like what I will say is this, and the Hubble palette, right, again, is not trying to preserve the actual colors. What it's trying to do is bring out the maximum amount of detail in the image so that you can
Yeah.
see more, right? So you can
Yeah.
see the structure and infer get more info out of the image. It's not about true color necessarily,
Yeah.
but it's about faithful reproduction of the details for some
Yeah.
purpose.
But even the Hubble and JWST images, those are not science
Yeah.
images that are being presented to the public.
Right.
Those are
Right.
public image, or those are
Right.
artistic images to make the science interesting to the public.
Yeah, sure.
Okay,
Yes.
so they are processed
Right.
and things are done to them that
Right.
are the scientists are not doing.
Right.
Yeah.
About the most that the scientists do is the biased art flat field stuff and that
Yeah.
about it.
Okay. Okay.
And I noticed that in a few months we will be having as our speaker one of the people from STSCI who produces those public images,
Yes.
Frank Summers.
Yep. Very excited.
I mean,
Man in the back.
do they ever show the two images side by side? So you can see the difference. I know the public, like the science, what
Yeah, what is
science
a good
does.
Well,
question?
the science is usually sort of the monochrome single frame image.
Yeah.
I mean, I would love to see the
And
difference.
yeah, somewhere they sometimes do. It just depends on what they're trying to communicate.
And
And
also, Elizabeth,
also,
a lot of what they use it for is more like the spectroscopy, right? A
yeah,
lot of times they don't
yes,
even look at the pictures, they look at the spectral fingerprints and get a lot of the science out of that.
yeah,
Like if I'm looking for methane on an exoplanet, I'm not looking at a picture of the planet, I'm looking at the spectral signal.
screen
Yes.
dip.
Yeah, so actually, thank you. And this is an art.
That's for
I'm going
the
to answer from an
physicists.
art perspective, not the science. There is, so if you're a serious content creator, right, there is software that you can use and monitors that have what's called a very wide color gamut, and you can calibrate your display to a particular standard. The problem that I run into, right, and I have, right, there's an iPhone, an iPad, a Mac. If I take the same image and I look at it on these three devices, the color is, and this is from the same manufacturer, right? But they're made at different times and different display technologies. It's not the same, right? So the dynamic range, the color gamut, like the P3 compliant display is going to be different than what's on that iPhone. You know what? You do the best you can. But you're absolutely right. Depending on the device you look at, it's gonna. The one thing I will say is like if you calibrate with like Adobe RGB and you send it to a printer, like a high quality printer, you can get some control over the color space or color science that way.
Two questions.
Yeah.
Actually, just one. The most popular telescope ever made is the CA.
Yes.
So, what was your opinion of people using an old C8 and a decent mount
I think
for?
so this particular camera right here, and this is a little bit older technology, so it does have the amp flow, but you can calibrate that out. The chip on this is relatively small, but very high resolution. So 20 megapixels, good performance, good quantum efficiency. Of this particular refractor, it's only imaging the center part of the frame.
And the reason for that is that a lot of galaxies are small. So I want a tighter crop on those galaxies. Why am I saying this? The issue with the Schmidt-Cassegrains is that they suffer from coma on the edges of the field. You can correct that to some extent. It's going to cost you like a $500 star Arizona filter or corrector. But the point is, some of that is intrinsic to the SCT design. But if you're imaging relatively small objects and you have a relatively small sensor, it doesn't matter because all of those distortions tend to occur on the periphery of the field. So just take the centerpiece and your telescope should be fine. Make sure it's collimated though.
That's the biggest issue with any of the Schmidt-Cassegrains is the collimation. Mm-hmm. Is going to become, when you're photographing, you're going to notice if it's out of collimation because it's just going to be fuzzy no matter what. Yeah. And we have that problem with the data that we collect here. Mm-hmm. We have the 14-inch and it is kind of eternally fuzzy compared to the refractor.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. And because its focus is much, much softer because of the collimation. Mm-hmm. It's just a tear off. It's
just something inherent in the Schmidt-Cassegrain design.
Got the obstruction.
We got the central obstruction as well.
You're going to get the diffraction.
And then those are also, they're kind of long focal length and they're large focal ratio. So F10s, F11s. So they're slow. So you kind of need, a little bit more time, kind of. But yeah.
But you can do it.
Yeah, you can certainly do it. I did it. I use my C8 piggyback mostly.
So honestly, that guy, like for some objects, if you're taking, if it's galaxy season and you're taking images of small galaxies, that's the only tool for the job.
Yeah.
Like you bite the bullet on the exposure time.
Yeah.
You get a camera that's really highly quantum efficient. But that refractor is, it's 540 millimeter focal length, right? So this is actually really good for a lot of nebula. It's a little small, but you can use mosaicing, which I didn't talk about, but you can actually do auto mosaicing. For like the Andromeda Galaxy and the Orion Nebula are a bit too large for that. But there's a lot of smaller galaxies that is just on the edge of, right? So that's why I use that small chip camera to be able to do imaging of things like the Iris Nebula and smaller galaxies. But for the really small stuff, the only way to go is with a long focal length and a wide aperture. So your Schmidt-Cassegrain is great.
It's the mount.
The reflector, the mount is a huge, going back to the mount. If you're going to go with a reflector, the optimal design is what Hubble actually is, which is hyperbolic mirrors. So it's a Ritchie Creighton design. They're expensive, but they're also, the worst thing about them is you think Schmidt-Cassegrains are hard to collimate. I heard the RCTs are really, really tough.
Yeah, I've heard the same.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Is there a certain scenario where we have to use multiple telescopes pointing at the same object to get a good shot?
So there are use cases for that. So I mentioned before, there are certain objects that you can get really interesting photos of by using both broadband and narrowband filters. So if you have a region that is complex, Barnard's loop around Orion, where you've got the flame nebula and you've got the horsehead and all that, where you have objects that are emissive, that are reflective, yada, yada, or you've got galaxies where you want to really enhance that hydrogen alpha. So you take a broadband image and then you take a narrowband image with a different telescope and you combine them. Well, why do you do that? Because you don't want to spend multiple nights imaging the same thing. So you get, the other thing is that so this is a really old trick the broadcasting industry used to do. The old television pictures were sampled at a higher resolution in luminance, and then the color data was a fraction of the spatial resolution. The reason is your eye can't see color detail as well as it can luminance detail. In other words, brightness, it's more sensitive to brightness at the higher spatial frequencies than color. So you can take an image that is really high resolution in luminance, a monochrome image, and then combine that with RGB data. It's called an LRGB image. And you can get some improvement in quality by going that route. It's extra work, of course, is you always pay the price.
There's also extra processing and things when you're dealing with images from different scales,
mm-hmm.
and things like that. So you have, your software has to be able to handle that. It seems to me that one of the clubs, I want to say Howard Astronomical League or one of them, they have a Discord or whatever, and I think I have seen them talking about where they have an object of the month and they get all of their astro imagers
Oh, wow.
To combine
To
data, and it's all different cameras and telescopes. Mm-hmm. And someone is also
different sites.
Yeah, but that requires a lot more processing power, and that's a lot harder. Like some of our software, if I accidentally take a bias in a at a different bin than my actual images, my software will choke.
Oh yeah.
You know, and so it's not happy. So it's a little bit trickier processing.
So basically,
the first biophysical.
You can do it. You just have to.
It's the first biophysical society meeting I went to was in 1960.
Okay.
And the keynote speaker there was a guy by the name of Edwin Land, as in Polaroid. And he showed an image which he took through three different filters. A red filter, a green filter, and a blue filter. And he combined them, and he got color.
Yes.
That was a big deal back then.
Well, have you ever seen the images from the Apollo missions where, like, whenever an object moves quickly in the frame, it's got, like, the color fringing on it?
Yeah.
It's because they didn't have a bare matrix. They actually had a color wheel that was spinning on a monochrome Hasselblad. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Sure. Sure.
How often is the technology changing here? Like, is there new cameras every year?
Yes. Yes.
The one you just bought is out of date.
An iPhone. It's one every year.
That's right. Yes.
So,
astonishing.
I will say this. So, the Sony makes the imaging chips for most of these cameras, and so, like I said, this is a Sony mirrorless camera. Right here, it's intended actually for landscape photography, but you can get away with some wildlife for it. Different trade-offs depending on the different models. These cameras update every few years. So, you know, you're on a 2 to 3 year cycle, you'll get a new chip from Sony and you'll have all the manufacturers come out with new cameras with the chip.
And that means you can buy a very good one. But
yeah,
only a few years.
That's correct. So if you're willing to lag a little bit, you can save a lot of money.
But having said that, and operating on a university budget, we're still using a camera that came out in the late 90s at its heyday, the S-Big ST series, was already kind of old when we bought them in 2010 or so, and we're still using them. So, and it actually still does a really good job for what it does. And it's well matched to our telescopes in terms of the pixel scale. And, you know, the best thing is that it's not a huge mega. How many hard drives do you have attached to your computer? Because he was saying, you know, each image is 26 megapixel.
Yeah.
Each image out of the ST10 camera is only about 3 megapixel.
Right.
And we have a new camera that we just got for the fall semester, and it is a 26 megabyte, and it is killing my hard drive space and my Dropbox space that the students are collecting data. It's killing it.
I would say that's what you're going to upgrade most is your storage.
Yeah.
So
because it's not just your raw images. Right. It's all the calibration and all that.
Right.
The news is storage is cheap.
Storage is cheap, relatively speaking. It is. But the beauty of, like we were saying before, is these optics are last a lifetime, right? I mean, you can buy a telescope from 20, 30 years ago, and it's super, super sharp. What has improved is, I think, the machining of the lenses has gotten better. The coatings on the lenses has gotten a bit better.
And the mounts and the drives, think, has been the other big jump here in the last 10-15 years. I mean, so we had German equatorials for a long time, but then they're coming out with these harmonic drives, which are smaller, less, are they less expensive? I mean, like the astrophysics mounts
they're
a couple of $1,000 for a good one.
Yeah, so I mean, so that AM5 is about $2,000.
That's a, my Ioptron, about the same price.
Yeah,
so it's the drive systems are improving and things like that, so that really helps, and they're more capable than some of the older ones.
So if you're going to invest today, a good mount will last you 10-20 years,
a long time.
Okay. I mean, they don't really wear out.
Sure.
The optics are going to last a lifetime if
right.
you want to take care yeah. of them.
Right.
What's going to change is the electronics.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
Okay. This has a little processor in the box on the side there.
Yep.
I'm sure there'll be a new generation of that in a year or two.
Yeah.
More, you know, more processing, more storage.
Yeah.
Cameras, the chips are improving on a couple year cycle probably.
Sure.
You know, so that's the, you know, that's where you put your
software.
The software,
but I will say this. So this Sony camera is like prosumer grade, but this is about a 10-year-old camera.
Yeah.
So I do have a couple in this line because I do wildlife and other things. But I keep my stuff for a long time. I don't rebuy unless there's a compelling yeah. reason to.
Yeah.
And yeah, go ahead.
Well, on the other aspect of it is that the stuff that does get outdated,
sure,
still has some resale value, and that can you be used to
yeah.
reduce the cost.
Yes, you can trade in. Absolutely.
I mean, you have a swap coming up.
However, if you have something from Mead
mm-hmm.
or Orion,
yeah. okay. yes, well,
you are screwed.
That's right? Right.
If it breaks.
If it breaks.
If it breaks. Well,
there are
places that will fix it.
I mean, it's all going to break at some point. It's just
yeah.
a question
of yeah, yeah. Actually, Guy would know this certainly more. How long does a mirror last, like a luminized mirror?
Forever.
It has to be.
The coating or the mirror itself?
Well, the coating. I mean, so the glass itself will last forever if you take
Correct.
Care of it. But how often do you have to, like, have the mirror cleaned and then recoated?
You don't have to.
Okay.
Places like Mount Wilson that you know,
it's exposed.
That are open to the sky just about every clear night.
Yeah.
You know,
they
that's
do.
A lot of dust.
It is.
And, you know,
yeah.
astronomers, professional astronomers at Carnegie told me, you'd be surprised how filthy are the mirrors are that produce all kinds of published research.
Yeah.
So they say, but, you know, you clean it when you want to. And, you know, if you want bare aluminum, you know, we can do it in an hour or two.
Okay.
Virtually nothing.
Wow.
You want overcoating, you're going to have to pay a lot of money, not to us, to somebody else.
To somebody else.
We can't.
Question.
But, you know, bare aluminum can last 10 years.
That's pretty decent.
Overcoated silver lasts 3-4 years.
Wow.
I'm amazed, and it works well.
Wow.
Speculum.
every time.
Speculum.
I have a C8 from
yes.
treated there. Not
40 years ago,
uh-huh.
and it's still
fine.
Yes, yes.
I've got some Dove 70 20, 30 years ago.
I know.
But those are more exposed when they're in the Schmidt Cassegrain. You have that corrector plate
that
really protects it.
I'm sorry, one in the back here.
Also, I.
No, oh, she's in the back.
She's
in the back.
We'll come around. I'm sorry, man.
Go to printer when you're going to print your images.
Yeah, actually, let me just find it because I have several of them. But the one I really like is Content Cloud. I go to Shutterfly, honestly. Like I print out for friends and family, and I do my post in Adobe Photoshop, and then I send it off to Shutterfly, and they do a really good job. Now I stay like to 8x10. I haven't done anything like you know super large, but yeah.
There are some specialty places that will do on like metal plates.
Yes. Things, yeah. You know? Well.
Yeah.
There's one.
There's one in Mount Pleasant, which has done a fabulous job. And I actually went to the exhibit after the party for Gail, and I was super impressed with the quality of the prints. They were absolutely gorgeous.
They are.
They're really nice. That was my first time. I don't live right around there, so it took a little bit to find it. But no, it was fantastic. Really, really fantastic.
My astrophotography is more AABSO stuff.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, the pretty pictures don't interest me that tremendously.
Sure.
Much.
All good.
Yeah, I believe my guy mentioned software and one problem you can get into with trying to use old cameras and such are drivers.
Mm-hmm.
Like the driver that came with it might no longer be compatible with the version of the operating system you have.
Yeah,
right.
And maybe
right.
for like Windows 7 or something.
Right.
We're actually running into that problem now because we're still using these older SBIC cameras, and every few years we're updating our computers, and we're starting to run into the problem where the camera or the computer OS is no longer supporting the older cameras.
Yeah.
And then when we tried to, or the older software, so then if we tried to go to newer software like Nina, it doesn't handle the old SBig cameras.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
So
go ahead, Jerry. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
It all talks about how to and why and all basic in betweens to take pictures. What resource would you say is the best to give you the inspiration of what picture to take?
So the one I really came across and love recently is called Cosmic Captures. The guy has a website and a YouTube channel, and he produces really, really high quality content. And every month he basically gives you a list of interesting objects that are, you know, some of them are super challenging. Some of them are, you know, beginner level. They'll tell you what kind of optics, what kind of focal lengths, what kind of filters to use to image them. He does Northern and Southern Hemisphere, but he does a really, really good job of giving you a variety of targets for that particular time of year.
How many would you say came from his?
What's that?
How many of your own photos came from what he did?
Here's my story. I got out of astrophotography for a while because I lived in places where I thought, you know what? It's hard to get a telescope out and image the sky. So I always had that interest. It was about a year ago that I joined this club and thought, I'm going to put some time back into astrophotography, and I really want to go with this. So I would say the Iris Nebula that you saw a picture of, that was from his catalog. And that was something I would not have picked otherwise, because a lot of them are like, you know, the California Nebula, the North American, that sort of thing, the Orion, the Flame, etc.
Same old.
But there's a lot of other stuff out there. I would also say, by the way, get one of those planetarium software packages and just start looking at the NGC catalog and whatnot. You would be amazed. Just walk through those programs and look at the wealth of different targets that are out there that are just not commonly known.
Yep. So another resource is AstroBin, and that's kind of where a lot of astrophotographers have their galleries. What's kind of nice is that they usually have the information about how they took the image, what filters they used, things like that. So that's kind of a good resource. Huh?
Cloudy Nights is good too.
They give you a cheat sheet.
Not a cheat sheet, but you can sort of see, you can search on a target and see some of the different ways that people have taken it and stuff, and how the equipment and everything varies and how it looks.
What was the name of that?
Cosmic Captures. Go to YouTube and just type in Cosmic Captures. I think he's from, is a gentleman with like a European accent. I don't know if he's,
It's like we live in a place with low light pollution.
You know, it's interesting. I think he travels around a lot and takes pictures under different conditions. But he's trying to be as like broad as he can in terms of like the rig that you have, and looking at different skill levels within the viewership and ensuring that he's got something for everybody. But really high quality content.
Who is this you're talking about?
It's called Cosmic Captures. I don't remember the gentleman's name, but if you go to YouTube and just type in or on the web, he's got a website. He also has a calendar that shows, like, you know, when the moon is out and when different objects in his recommended list are optimally placed in the sky and whatnot. He's got a really comprehensive website for astrophotography. In terms of other things, I think Trevor from Astro Backyard is a really good source as well. I think he's very inspiring. He's a Canadian who obviously, hence the name of the title, shoots out of his backyard. And then there's a gentleman from Australia that's a very colorful individual named Dylan O'Donnell.
Hang out. I mean,
he can offend some people from time to time.
No one's days, or no. So here's the Cosmic Captures.
Oh, yeah, if you just do like the November video, you'll get a sense of what he does. He also does a lot with meteor showers in particular. I like this.
It's deciding not to.
Dylan O'Donnell. is the Australian guy.
Have you tried 3i Atlas?
What's that?
Have you tried 3i Atlas yet?
No, I haven't. I'll take that down. 3i Atlas.
It just came out from Solar Conjunction or whatever.
It's above Venus.
Oh, cool.
Right, it's the nearest planet, I think.
It's a morning target though, right?
Yeah. It's
okay.
But it's at 9:28.
I think Chong actually was trying to build it.
You can see. You can see. As long as you have an exposure, I think it was like
east, right?
In east, yeah, just before sunrise. It's.
Is it acting up on you?
Yeah, it's acting up on me. So dadgummit. Anyway, people can come up to the computer here and.
Yeah.
See it.
Yeah, well, then you have to get your alignment before, yeah, long before that, and then you can get a shot at it right now.
So have y'all, speaking on 3i, did some of y'all hear about how NASA is activating its planetary defense system?
Yes, I did see that.
Good.
What's its planetary defense?
It's about time.
So that was that kind of some of that hoopla was because of an MPEG that got released by the NPC from this observing campaign. I am the poor soul who is vetting all the people who are trying to register for that campaign, and all the stupid idiots who would clearly say you have to have this level of equipment to do this, and they're registering. I don't have a telescope yet, but I want to learn. And, but yes, I'm dealing with that. I won. So. Fun stuff. Crazy people.
People are saying, Guy, you have a sea star. I have a dwarf 3. I get amazing things out of it. I mean, amazing. And I can set it up. I can schedule it to go all night. I mean, see if I get up some morning.
Just plug it in.
I've got everything.
I might have to get a new one.
I don't have a 10 star.
Is it the port? It's
no. I think it's the cable could be dying. I think there was a little bit of wiggly on yours. No, yours is really nice.
All right, here's
climbing up is extremely difficult.
Oh, he's Swedish. That's what it is.
How much daylight there? Yeah.
Let me see if I can get any sound.
Sky objects are at their best right now. So even if the days can feel bleak, the nights can be magnificent. My name is Tim, and you're watching Cosmic Captures. In this video, I will show you what's happening in the night sky, both north and south, and highlight some of the best objects to photograph this month so you can make most of your clear nights. Let's start by looking at what the moon is doing this month, because it really sets the rhythm for everything else we can capture.
Let me fast forward and show you some of his. Yeah, so he's got cool stuff like Pelican, the bubble, Thor's helmet.
L5, the Heart Nebula might be one of the few that truly lives up to its name. This region has everything a wide-field astrophotographer could wish for. It's large, relatively bright, and packed with beautiful structure and detail. You can frame it wide with a short telephoto lens around 135 millimeters and include the close-by Sol Nebula. Or zoom in on the heart of the heart, Melotte 15, that twisting corkscrew-like formation at its core. It looks great in broadband, but with narrowband filters, the Heart Nebula really comes alive, revealing intricate filaments of hydrogen, oxygen, and sulfur that makes it one of the most rewarding nebulae to capture this autumn sky. And if you'd like to learn more about what's happening inside this nebula and how to capture it, you will find more details on my website, cosmiccaptures.com.
Also Shell's t-shirt too.
Yes, absolutely. I'm sure he's got plenty of time to do this channel because it's a lot of content.
Any questions online? I didn't see anything in the chat.
Okay.
It got quiet on the online. Okay. Then
thank you all.
When I did checked earlier, it was kind of clear, so I can open up the telescope, the observatory, and point the telescope at a couple of targets. If anyone's going to hang around for that, is anyone going to?
Sure.
I'm not going to start doing it unless people hang around. All
I'll
right,
hang
good.
around.
All right, cool. All right, folks, we'll see you later.
It's Saturday, right?
Thank you.
Absolutely.
End up being another
Yeah.
organization.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. I'm sorry to meet you.